14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Okay, we got that done. 19. Instead of reading all through this word-for-word narrative here, it's pretty self-explanatory. The basic lesson that we can get out of this is the methods that things are accomplished politically speaking. And it's done through perversion. And let's go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us to understand your words. I do pray you'd help us to be faithful to your words. Help us to know that the Bible does help us understand what's going on as far as our country. And also as far as churches go. And Lord, I do pray you'd help us to understand these words in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, you read many things in the Old Testament. You learn how God deals through governing structures or governments. And in the New Testament, aims more toward the individual. In 2 Samuel, you have here in verse chapter 14 and following, you have the behind-the-scenes pictures of what goes on in politics. Okay, politics, I look at politicians as parasites. That's how I view them. Politicians are parasites, in my opinion. Statesmen are a little bit different. Statesmen are servants. In our country, they originally were to be servants, but things have changed to be parasites. Now, the way things work in politics behind the scenes is each feller or people on this side of the aisle versus that side of the aisle are always trying to catch the other party in some compromise position so that they can blackmail them. Okay, and that's the pattern. In this story is Joab is trying to get a catch over David and Absalom. So he's trying to get the high ground over these two characters. Joab is the military general. Absalom, in the previous chapter, remember, had killed his half-brother Amnon for his sinful act against Tamar. And so Absalom has left. And Joab is going to try to use this example, this sin or crime of Absalom, which actually he should have received the death sentence for, but Amnon should have received the death sentence before that. So Absalom wouldn't have had to do what he did, I guess. And so Joab is going to use this to try to get a high ground or an in with David where he could blackmail David whenever he wants to. Now, Joab already knows something about David. Remember back in chapter 11 and 12? Bathsheba, Uriah. So he already has a catch on David, and now he's trying to get a catch on Absalom. And so the common saying goes like this, that compromise makes cowards of us all. Okay, where a person has done wrong, David did wrong with Bathsheba, and so the problem is because he did that, then he doesn't feel right about executing justice against Absalom because he himself did not receive justice. And conscience is the right word I should have said. Conscience makes cowards of us all. So Absalom is out of the kingdom. Joab is going to try to bring him back. And in verse 2 and 3, Joab is coaching a woman to give a story to David. He probably thinks, well, this worked on for Nathan. Nathan gave a story to David, and then he said, David, you're the one. So he's using the same principle, the same idea. And at the end of verse 3, you see a common saying. So Joab put the words in her mouth, okay? And the common saying is, don't put words in my mouth. And he told this story, he had this woman tell this story about a son, two brothers, her sons, getting in a fight. One kills the other in the fight. And the revenger of blood wants to bring the death sentence upon him. And she's saying, then I'm not going to have a son at all. And so, king, what should I do? And King David, in this case, said, "Not your son's not going to receive the death sentence." And so, and then he realized that Joab is the one that gave her the words. If you would drop down to verse 17. "Then the handmaid said, 'The word of my lord the king shall now be comfortable, for as an angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and bad.'" Discern good and bad. "Therefore the Lord thy God will be with thee. Then the king answered and said unto the woman, 'Hide not from me, I pray thee, the thing that I shall ask thee.' And the woman said, 'Let my lord the king now speak.' And the king said, 'Is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this?' And the woman answered and said, 'As thy soul liveth, my lord the king, none can turn to the right hand or to the left from aught that my lord the king hath spoken, for thy servant Joab, he bade me, and he put all these words in my mouth of thine handmaid.'" So David had figured it out. Joab was using this situation to get some advantage over him. And in verse 20, he says, "To fetch about this form of speech hath thy servant Joab done this thing, and my lord is wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God to know all things that are in the earth." Okay, now he's twice said something about angels of God. So angels of God hear what's spoken in secret because they're in the spirit world. The spirit world's right parallel to our physical world. And this is where a common saying often is used, that a little birdie told me something. A little bird, birds picture spirits, angels are spirits. And so this is passed on that way. And so David has a connection in with the Lord. So he sees what's going on. This is how politicians get political gain. If you do watch politics, if you're involved in that, and you see somebody on the right side and the left side getting together over something, it's usually, not always, but usually it's because one of them have something on the other, or vice versa, or both. Sadly, that's how it works. And the saddest thing now is that this also has been brought into the church, where, you know, or a Christian college where a professor has something over a student over a professor, this professor over that one, and that's what's called dirty politics. So verse 21, "The king said unto Joab, 'Behold, now I have done this thing. Go therefore, bring the young man Absalom again.'" Okay, so Joab is trying to get Absalom and David to be reconciled, obviously for political gain. And Absalom is a character that would be on some of these, yuppie magazines, or People magazine, where he'd be the handsomest guy in the country. Okay, and he's going to use that for his political gain. Absalom, in type, portrays the Antichrist. So if you look at the Bible doctrinally, focus on the doctrinal picture. When you read about Absalom, you will see very unique pictures of the Antichrist and how he will get political favors. Verse 25, "But in all Israel there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him." Okay, so he had, as far as the world goes, he would have been Ken. You know, Barbie and Ken. Okay, and so that's him. Who's Barbie? Who knows? Okay, but all of that stuff is just the world's opinion of trying to place this is what makes somebody, you know, beautiful or handsome or whatnot. Verse 26, "And when he polled his head," for it was every year's end that he polled it, because the hair was heavy on him, therefore he polled it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels after the king's weight. How much is that? Five to 8 pounds of hair. So if he got lice, that would have been pretty bad. So this dude was the girls loved his hair and all that stuff. Okay, verse 27. Unto Absalom there were born three sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar. Obviously, he could see that he named it after his sister, and she was a woman of fair countenance. So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face. So he came back to Jerusalem, but David just wouldn't allow him to come all the way reconciliation. So here's what a typical kid does of royalty in order to get his way. This is people who are born with a silver spoon in their mouth, rich kids. Now, one of the first times this, where I noticed this in life was over at Grace College. I never really noticed this before, but over at Grace College, it's a very wealthy area. It's a big lake there, wealthy people. And I was told that, in the public schools, that drugs is just flowing through that public schools because of the wealth of the kids. And I'm thinking, man, you would think that something else would, satisfy them kids. But the idea is that they had nothing to live for because they've been given everything to them. And so they're trying to find some thrill, some other route. When a wealthy parent gives his 18-year-old boy, a Corvette, what's a kid got to look forward to later in life? Lamborghini? I mean, he should be driving at 18, driving a beater. They don't deserve something like that at that age. That's for later on in life, for a wealthier car, or a nicer car. That's part of earning things in life. Sometimes kids think they deserve everything at 16. This is often a problem in young couples as they come from a household where mom and dad have struggled for years and now they're starting to get things put together and they've got some possessions, and here you got a young couple, they see all these possessions, they think, we got to have that too because that's what we just came out of. Yeah, but that was 20 years of somebody. And so a lot of kids get in deep debt because of that. No, you got to struggle. You got to work at it. You got to earn. You got to save. You got to plan. You got to curb your spending appetite. Things like that. If you don't, you see that we're not individually, we're not government where you could print the money endlessly. And even at that, they can't get away with it for eternity. It's eventually going to hit. I would have thought it would have hit a long time ago. But eventually, it's going to hit. It's like my sister and I, Janet and I, played Monopoly for days on end. And we had an unwritten rule between us that when you landed on certain properties, I always got these and she always got the other. And I always got Park Place and the last two blue ones. And she always ended up owing me buku money. I always ended up owning the bank. I don't know, my sister's building my ego. And she would have a tally sheet of IOU, and it would be huge numbers. And we can play indefinitely. Until she got so tired of the numbers, and then she'd mess up the whole thing, and start again. And but that's how it is in our government, the federal government. The state governments can't print endlessly, and so this is why they're being faced with this stuff. Where the federal government keeps printing it endlessly, but you and I can't do that. Credit cards have limits. And I'd read one time that the average American's credit card debt, average American, was over $30,000. I thought, And can you imagine the interest rates that they're putting on those things? Okay, and yes, America has a lot of wealth, but how people are just in debt like crazy. And so, but here's Absalom, a spoiled rich kid, like the Kennedys, where you could murder a secretary and get away with it. But they're not going to get away with it in the judgment. And so what does he do? He sets a guy's field on fire to get his attention. Verse 29, therefore Absalom sent for Joab to have sent him to the king, But he would not come to him, and when he sent again the second time, he would not come. Therefore he said unto his servant, See, Joab's field is near mine, and he hath barley there. Go set it on fire. And Absalom's servant set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and came to Absalom from his house and said unto him, Wherefore have thy servant set my field on fire? Absalom answered Joab, Oh, behold, I sent unto thee, saying, Come hither, that I may send thee to the king, to say, Wherefore am I come from Geshur? It had been good for me to have been there still. Now therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. I mean, no apology recorded. I just set your field on fire. How many acres was that? Barley, that's usually harvested before wheat. Barley hay, barley grass, 10 to 14 inches is very healthy for horses and people in general. Okay, but there's no record of him fixing this. Just like a brat, just sets a guy's field on fire. Years ago, my brother and I had a one tractor, our 4430, up in Leroy, the one field we had up north there, and that field was a half mile by field, 160 acres. And that field had every kind of dirt in it. It had a rolling, hard clay, regular clay, and then on the west side it had muck. If you know anything about muck, muck actually shakes as you walk on it. And 3 feet down, we put tile in it. It had a thin layer of shells, seashells, from when Lake Michigan came this far south. And muck is a proper ground that, man, this ground had springs that would move on us. And so we didn't even farm like 20 acres for years because you couldn't. And I was in sixth grade, 4'9" tall, whopping big kid, driving a tractor. And Dad would drive the disc around the muck spots so that I wouldn't go in the muck spot to get stuck. So I'm sitting on the tractor fender. You can't do that nowadays, probably. And all of a sudden, the front wheel disappears. And the spring moved on us. And you don't try to back it out because you make it worse. He turned off the tractor and he said, Don't go here. And so I said, Okay, I got that figured out. Well, we pulled the tractor out. Well, my brother and I had a 4430 over there and got it stuck, buried it. We only had one tractor, and it was 7-8 miles from the farm, so we had to go all the way home, get another tractor, came back. We came back, and the two side windows were missing, out. We thought it was a hot July day. We thought the sun got so hot in the tractor, blew the windows out. We found one bullet hole, one hole in the top part of the cab. Figured it out. Walked over to the road. There were 6 shells from a .22 rifle. We were being detectives. And so I walked down the road, saw some kids. You said and asked them, Do you see anybody walk down? Said, yeah, so-and-so. Two guys were over there squirrel hunting. And one kid said, Shut up. Well, who were those two guys? Well, we found out who they were. So we go to their house. And Dad found two parents. We called the coppers. The coppers said, Do as you wish. So my dad always has wonderful ways of getting kids' attention. And so his punishment was, first off, the boys had to pay for the windows getting fixed. And secondly, they had to work 2 days with us side by side picking up rocks. Now, Dad's ground, he has pretty good ground, but it has an amazing thing that it grows rocks every single year. And every spring, we're out there picking up stinking rocks. And so I think in the fall, we were going to do it this time. And so we had two boys. One had a German parents that when they showed up, the German dad said to his son in my dad's presence, he said, You are going to do everything this man says. Okay? And the other kid, his mom said, Oh, pay for the windows. And Dad said, No, he's got to pay for them. And they hired an attorney, and the kid didn't have to work one day with us. Well, the other boy, he works one whole day with us. He's dragging his hind end by the time we're done that day. And Dad just looked at him and said, "Son, I think you learned your lesson, didn't you?" He said, "Yes, sir, I did." And so he got off. But that other kid, you know where he ended up? Jail. He could have learned a valuable lesson if his mom would have let him learn a valuable lesson. You're going to be held accountable for your actions. You pay for it, pal, and you work it off. And that kid's been in jail, out of jail, in jail, out of jail. And the other kid learned a valuable lesson. I doubt Absalom would have had to pay for anything. Or he's on the king's dole. You know, rich kid, spoiled kid. And if you study war, many wars are caused by people just like Absalom, bankers' kids. Bankers. So verse 33, it says, "So Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king, bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom." So Absalom got his way. Now what does he do? Absalom's a snake. Verse 1, chapter 15. "It came to pass after this that Absalom prepared chariots and horses, 50 men to run before him." Oh, he's a big shot. Got his bodyguards. He's going to get all this attention. He's tall, dark, handsome. He's a Syrian Jew like Judas Iscariot. He's a type of the Antichrist. He manipulates gullible religious people through flattery and feigned love. Verse 2, "And Absalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate." Notice a guy that gets in this position has to have some ambition. They can't be lazy and get in this position. "And it was so that when a man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called on him and said, 'Of what city art thou?' And he said, 'Thy servant is of one of the tribes of Israel.' And Absalom said to him, 'See, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee.' Absalom said, 'Moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which hath in suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice.'" And people sat there and oohed and aahed. "Oh, if we just had a king like you, low-life scumbag." Verse 5, "And it was so that when a man came nigh to him to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took him and kissed him." It's what Judas betrayed the Lord with. "And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel." They believed him. And sadly, this is often how candidacies take place. This is what Obama does. This is what Clinton did. This is what all of them do. They say one thing when they're trying to get elected and do the opposite or do as they wish when they're in the office. Nothing different. And people sit there and believe that stuff. Huh? Right. I saw that. Yeah, what he's saying is he has Obama the candidate when he's talking about one topic was wiretapping. Where as a candidate, he was 100% opposed to it. As president, it's got its useful means. Yeah, how long is that video? It's
only like 10 minutes.
10 minutes. But he has him as a candidate, as a president, and the complete opposites. Right. Yep. Yep, that's exactly what they do. Okay, now verse 7, "And it came to pass after 40 years." Now, the scholars will quickly jump on that and say that's a contradiction. "It came to pass after 40 years." 40 years of what? That's the difficulty of that one. 40 years. Where is that after 40 years old for Absalom? After 40 years where David was anointed king. It's hard to pin that one down, but somebody who's honest wants to give God the benefit of the doubt. If you can't figure it out now, don't worry about it. The Lord will fix it when you get in front of him. If you want to guess on it, that's okay. Make sure you let people know that it's a guess. I would say the most logical guess is after 40 years of age for Absalom would be probably the most likely candidate. But we ought to be honest and let people know that it's just a guess or a hunch. It came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. Oh, now he's religious. Now he's going to take his Bible and walk into the Jewish synagogue or the temple and impress people that he's spiritual. He said, thy servant vowed a vow, which I abode at Geshur in Syria. Okay, in Syria, it makes him a Syrian Jew. That's his race, very similar to Judas Iscariot. Very similar to what the Antichrist would be. Saying, if the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. You bald-faced liar. But that's what these people do. I'm a Christian. That's how Jimmy Carter got in office. I'm a born-again Christian. Okay, and this is politicking. The king said unto him, go in peace. So he rose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as ye hear the sound of the trumpet, then ye shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called, and they went in their simplicity. In their simplicity, simple-minded people, in their simplicity, a simple man believeth every word, Proverbs says. They believe every word. Okay, and the thing is these people, he takes people who are gullible. Or they're vain. Okay, and they knew not anything. They did not know that Absalom had conspiracy in mind and insurrection in mind. Verse 12, and Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gileonite, David's counselor from his city, even from Gilon, while he offered sacrifices. This is Bathsheba's grandfather. I think that's who it is. Yep, Bathsheba's grandfather. So this guy already has a burr under his saddle with David. He's already mad at David. He's upset with him already. And the conspiracy was strong. Okay, a conspiracy is more than two or more people in an agreement to commit a crime. That's a conspiracy. It's amazing to me how all talk radio dispels conspiracies. I mean, you call Rushbo and you're a wacko if you believe in conspiracies. The Bible teaches, you know, the Bible doesn't say a conspiracy is a theory. It is a fact. It is a fact when you have somebody on the top of a hill, somebody below them want to knock them off. That's what sports is all made up of. When you got one team at the top, there's a conspiracy with this team to knock that one off. There's a conspiracy with this team to knock that one off, and they're going to do it by sports. That's just logical. And the same goes in life. Jeremiah warned about this conspiracy in Jeremiah 11, verse 9, in his day. And so there is a conspiracy, and there are several books up on conspiracies. And probably one of the first ones to warn our country of a conspiracy to overthrow our country was Samuel Morris, the famous Morris Code. The man that was given credit for the Morris Code. He wrote a couple books in the 1850s warning Americans about a conspiracy of the Jesuit priests trying to overthrow America. You don't hear that in the schools, do you? And that's what he tried to warn Americans back in the 1850s, and the Jesuits were probably in cahoots with Abraham Lincoln. So he's warned about it way back then. And of course, there's much more than that. Okay, it's a conspiracy. You know, and it's just all over the place, and you got this one and this one and this one and this one and this one, and of course we know that the devil's at the top of all of them. So in this case, the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Then there came a messenger to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom." Now what does he do? So now what does he do? He's king, and he knows that this has got to be a heartbreak for him, because his heart is towards Absalom, and now reality's setting in that this kid is crooked. This kid wants me dead. So what am I going to do? Verse 13. This is a horrible thing. I'd read about, there's a famous preacher that a lot of people know, a Southern Baptist guy. Who's the guy down in Georgia? Who? Charles Stanley. Charles Stanley, he's been preaching down there for years and years and years, and a lot of times you get a good message from him. Sadly, he's gone to the NIV, but even at that, I'd read an account that his own son caused a split in his church and took the split away, and then his wife divorced him, and then he's about ready to quit everything, and people try to encourage him to stay in it. But his son really, caused a big problem in his church, and then a lot of folks ran off with his son, and then he stayed where he was at. And I tell you, that's got to be a heartbreak. Okay, and so this has got to be a heartbreak for David, that's for sure. We'll pick up right there, 13, about what David does about it, his reaction. Okay. Next time. Next Thursday's 4th July, so we'll not have Thursday night Bible study. Besides, I'll be with the outlaws. In-laws. I'm in Pennsylvania. Lord willing. Okay, any prayer requests?